This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith today is Professor Rick Layton from the Program for the Study of Religion here at the University of Illinois. Professor Layton teaches a course in New Testament that's going on this spring semester, and we're talking today about the Gospel of John and specifically the relation of the Gospel of John to, quote, the Jews, a term that's used very often in that passage. We're particularly talking about the Passion story because of the performance that's coming up on March 17 of Bach's St. John's Passion. And that quotes a great deal. The words are from the Gospel of John. Welcome, Professor Layton.
Oh, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Good to have you here. Now, how many students take a course in the New Testament at this university?
Oh, about 30 in the spring.
Do you have to limit it to that number?
Oh, yes.
So there are many more who wish to take it. But
oh, yes.
And why aren't more sections taught?
You'll have to ask the chancellor that.
But it is a popular course, as are many of the courses in the program for the study of religion. Tell us about some of your colleagues. What are some of the things that are taught in the in your department?
Oh, goodness. I think that what we try to do is to introduce students to the basics of each of the major world traditions, and we have specialists in each of those traditions, but also to give them opportunities to think about issues across various traditions. So just to kind of give you a sample of what you might find in the program right now if you were to walk in. The first thing, of course, that most students know about is the World Religions course, which is a survey of each of the major world traditions. And then we have a course this semester in Religion in America, which I think is one of our newer offerings that we're very, very pleased to be able to do.
Who teaches that?
That's Professor John Ebel, who will be speaking this week at Friday Forum, I believe, right?
That's right, at the University of Hawaii this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that might have been one of his courses.
Yes, yes. I think you would also find this semester an introduction to Hinduism, two courses in Islam, and so just very much everything across the waterfront.
Today we're talking about the Christian scriptures they refer to as the New Testament. Is Christianity and its scriptures your specialty?
Yes. That's every year from the scriptures themselves all the way up to contemporary religious practice and rituals and interpretation.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Gospel of John, sometimes referred to as the fourth gospel. Why is that?
Called the fourth gospel. I like to say because in Christian tradition, at any rate, the ancient Christians looked at it, the Gospel of John, as being the cleanup hitter, that it was the fourth in the lineup, specifically because they understood that the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, gave what they considered to be the external facts of Jesus's life, where John was the theologian. John gave the inner significance of the life of Jesus, and that's why it's called the fourth gospel.
And I remember in times past, it was sometimes referred to as the most spiritual of the Gospels.
Yes, yes. That's very much so that I think John is such a fascinating text, and one that the more I read it, the less grasp I feel like I have of it, because it both cuts to kind of the existential bone of what Christianity is about, but also introduces in some of the most pronounced and unavoidable ways some of the problems that Christians have to deal with in their relationship specifically to Judaism. So it's a very, very difficult and, I think, thorny kind of text for Christians to work responsibly with.
Now, some of our listeners may not even, people from other religious traditions, for example, may not know what a what Christians mean by the term a gospel. Mm-hmm. Let's start. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start there? What is a gospel? These Matthew, mm-hmm. Mark, Luke, and John.
Right. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, of course, as I'd say probably most of your listeners know, is only one of only four of a number of texts produced by early Christians that are called gospels. And so what I'll do first is just explain the term gospel and then distinguish between different ways we can think of gospels and how Christians encounter that. Gospel is just simply a term for good news or a good announcement. It comes from the Greek word euangelium, which is what we get evangelist from. An evangelist is being one who announces good news. And originally it was a diplomatic term. You know, when an army won, they came back and told the people the good news that they have won. And so a gospel is a way of saying that the message of Christianity brings a sense of victory, of good news. This came up, could have several different kinds of settings in early Christianity. The first setting was oral, where people were preachers of the good news. And that didn't mean that they were telling the life story of Jesus. That meant they were announcing Jesus's victory, in a way, over the forces of death. And subsequently, after that oral tradition, there was a phase, a very long phase, longer than most people realize, when the oral tradition became kind of translated and transcribed into written texts, of which four are canonical, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then there's at least 30 more that were written somewhere between the years 50 and 200 that never made it into the Christian canon.
And the Christian canon is what we refer to as the New Testament.
That's right.
Of the Bible.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, when was the Gospel of John probably written in comparison to the other three Gospels?
Mm-hmm. Dating of any of the Gospels is kind of a tricky thing, and I think the best we can do with John is a fairly approximate and relative dating. And approximately, it seems that it must post-date the year 70, as is our nearest kind of chronological anchor we can put down. And relatively, it seems that it must postdate Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Somewhere between the years 90 and 100 would be what I'd say is a fairly well-grounded consensus on that.
And who wrote the Gospel of John?
I don't know.
It doesn't say, does it?
It doesn't say. Yes, that's the big, and I don't mean that very facetiously at all. It is an anonymous gospel, just like Matthew, Mark, and Luke also are anonymous. Surprisingly, the tradition associating it with John is a fairly late date. We don't really have good evidence for any Christians linking it with the traditional apostle John until about the year 170 to 200. So even its traditional linkage to John is fairly weak.
Now, there was a time when scholars would say, refer to the first three Gospels by the name of the person associated with them, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but they would sometimes say the writer of the fourth Gospel. Is there less demonstration for John than there are for the first three?
Well, there may be two separate issues that way. And so let me kind of distinguish two difficulties, and then we can try to work from there. First is it's fairly difficult to really pin down when the Gospel of John achieved the form it has today, that it apparently has gone through several different editions, we might call it, to reach the point that it has today. And so who do you finally credit as the author? Is it the first person who kind of originated the tradition, or is it the last person who put it together in the kind of form we have it today? The second issue is more specifically on what can we know about any of the authors. And I don't think there is really that much good tradition about any of the four canonical Gospels. One of the surprising things is that the earlier the Gospel, the less claim it makes about its own authorship. It seems that the later Gospels wanted to make claims about apostolic origins, fairly embarrassed about that. Early Christians didn't really seem to invest in the same concept of authorship as has later developed.
And by apostolic origins, you mean?
The claim that the written text itself was produced by a commissioned follower of Jesus, this seems to only have become important about the year 150 or so.
Hmm. And where was the Gospel of John written?
Again, I don't know. The traditional place or where it is in early Christianity was seen to arise from a city in Asia Minor called Ephesus, because this is where, in tradition, the Apostle John spent the rest of his days after his tour with Jesus. And many people have revisited this issue, and I have yet to come up with an especially convincing place that this gospel must have originated from. Somewhere in the Roman Orient, though, I think would be the best. Palestine, Syria, Asia Minor.
We're talking with Professor Rick Layton from the Program in the Study of Religion here at the University of Illinois, and today this is the second in a series of three Keeping the Faith programs in a row that are dealing with the interesting issue of the relation of the Gospel of John to the Jews of the time of Jesus, partly because of Bach's use of this text, the Gospel of St. John's story of the arrest and crucifixion and death of Jesus as part of his passion narrative, his passion choral work, magnificent choral work, that's going to be performed on this campus in Smith Music Hall on March 17 at 7:30. The Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana will be giving that concert, directed by Chet Alwis, who's a professor from the Department of Music, the School of Music, who will be our guest next week on Keeping the Faith. Last week, you might, if any of you missed that, we had a very interesting interview with Professor Michael Shapiro, who is the director of the, what's the actual term I'm forgetting, the
Jewish culture.
Culture and Society, director of the Program for Jewish Culture and Society at the university. And Professor Shapiro talked about some of the difficulties in this text from his perspective, and today we're fortunate to have Rick Layton, who teaches New Testament at the university, among other things, talking about this. Listeners are encouraged to call in with comments or questions. Let me give the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines you can reach by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, toll-free. Anywhere you're hearing this, including on the internet, if you're within the continental U.S., toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So toll-free, if it's long distance, do use 1-800-222-WILL to join this conversation. This is a live program from 5 to 6 here on WILL AM 580 on Sunday evenings. My name's Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs, and I'm having fun talking about this interesting and provocative topic. Rick, when we talk about the difficulties within John, you don't have to start reading this gospel and get very far. In the first chapter, there's a reference to the Jews who were opposing, in this case, John the Baptist, even, yeah, before we get to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And on almost every page, there's a reference mm-hmm. to the Pharisees as well as the Jews, and the Jews were out to get Jesus. And mm-hmm. Then in the end, when we get to the final story of what Christians call the Passion or the Suffering of Jesus, then it's three or four references mm-hmm. per paragraph sometimes. Mm-hmm. What was going on? Why was there this opposition to Jesus from the Jews, or was there?
I think the first thing I'll kind of build on that you've mentioned is the kind of rhetorical place of these people called the Jews in the Gospel of John. And It is one of the noticeable differences from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which I'll call jointly the Synoptic Gospels here.
Because they tend to tell the same story.
Yes.
Same kind of way.
Yes. They sort of three versions of the same story, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, whereas John really takes a different path altogether. And just to give you a comparison, John refers to the Judaioi, the Jews, 67 times in his gospel, whereas Matthew, which is very, very steeped in Jewish tradition, refers to the Jews, I believe, 6 times, just to give you some sort of relative sense of the rhetorical force that this repetition of the term Jews has in the Gospel of John. And so one question that we want to pursue is, why does John choose this term to this label to, in a way, summarize anything that seems to oppose Jesus? And, you know, there are times I want to build on that, but I also want to acknowledge that sometimes the way the Gospel of John uses seems just plain odd because it gives you the impression that Jesus is not a member of this group called the Jews, whereas one of the few things we're very certain about Jesus is that he was Jewish. And then not only that, you'll even see, for example, in the Lazarus episode, when Jesus comes to heal his friend Lazarus, Lazarus's sister Mary is there weeping, and she hears Jesus coming, and it says, Mary and the Jews who were with her come to meet Jesus. And that's just an odd reference, again, sort of separating Mary from everyone else there. So the Jews—
Who was a friend of Jesus.
Who was a friend of Jesus in this. And so, and the disciples are never referred to as Jews.
And yet we know they were.
Yes. So it seems that the first thing a reader will do with that reference then, I think, is to feel that it has some sort of rhetorical energy in there that isn't fully explained. So, you know, that's the first question about that. And these Jews are portrayed as being in opposition to Jesus himself. And I think that's the second thing we want to realize that is distinctive about the Gospel of John, as opposed to the synoptic tradition. In the synoptic tradition, Jesus gets into lots of scrapes and arguments with people who sometimes oppose him, sometimes see his way of looking at things. And these arguments are usually fairly concrete. For example, people will come and say, well, why don't you have your disciples observe the Sabbath? And Jesus will say, well, you know, there's this situation that calls for a kind of bending of the rule or something like that. And so the dispute isn't really about Jesus. It's about what are the norms of Sabbath observance. In the Gospel of John, we see a subtle but significant shift where the argument no longer is about whether or not you should observe the Sabbath, but about Jesus himself. And I'll give you just an example of this. In John chapter 5, Jesus is in Jerusalem, and he goes by a pool, and he sees a lame man. It's on the Sabbath, and the lame man says, you know, well, I can't walk around or anything like this. Jesus says, okay, take up your pallet and walk, and the guy gets up and walks. And he's then confronted by the Jews for working on the Sabbath because he's carrying his pallet. And the man says, well, this is what Jesus told me to do. And so then the fight becomes about Jesus himself as one who authorizes the breaking of the Sabbath. And Jesus doesn't say, well, we have all these extenuating situations. He says, my Father has worked until today, and I will also work. So he sort of sets himself directly in opposition to the Sabbath. So those are that's the second kind of layer of problem here.
And who's the Father he refers to?
Well, it has to be God the Father in this case, yes. So you have two layers of problems. You know, the opposition of Jesus seems to be this kind of unified faceless people called the Jews, and the opposition about Jesus turns precisely on the nature of Jesus himself. And that all comes to a head in the Passion narrative.
And that distinction that you're pointing to in John, that attitude towards Jesus as he's portrayed in this gospel is very different from the other three.
Oh, sharply different, yes. And it probably isn't one that casual readers of the gospel text would really pick up on, because most Christianity has been so Johannized that Christians tend to believe that right from the beginning there was a sense in which opposition to Jesus turned on a kind of claim he made to be the Christ. And we need to point out here that, in fact, in the synoptic tradition, Jesus never, ever makes a public claim either to the messiahship or, in the more charged fashion in the Gospel of John, to being, quote-unquote, the Son of God. These are two things that, at least in Jesus' public dealings, are unique to the Gospel of John and situate the conflict in an entirely different way than we see in the synoptic tradition.
When we get to the Passion story, the story of the arrest and eventual crucifixion of Jesus in the Gospel of John, it seems to intensify the opposition from the Jews, yeah. Particularly in discussion with Pilate, the chief of the high priest. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I've been really studying the Passion narrative very closely in the last few weeks. And it seems to me that there's two basic trends that you can see, again, moving from the synoptics to the Gospel of John. One trend has to do with the sense of Jesus being utterly in control of his own destiny in the Gospel of John. The other trend is the one that you mentioned, is that that the opposition to Jesus is very much in the hands of the Jews, and Pilate is kind of their puppet. And that's something that I think merits at least a couple minutes to talk about. If you move from the earliest of the Synoptic Gospels, Mark, through Matthew, then to Luke, and then finally to John, there's an astonishing shift as each gospel seeks in ways either subtle or more explicit to shift the blame of the crucifixion away from the Romans and onto the Jews. And it's palpably clear, just to give you a sense of how this works. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is arrested by the temple guard, and he's brought before a trial in the Jewish assembly, the Sanhedrin. And having been convicted of blasphemy by the Sanhedrin, they then take him to the Roman authorities, Pilate. Pilate is depicted in Mark as a kind of bored bureaucrat who doesn't really want to waste his precious time on this problem. So knowing that, as it says, it would please the people, he turns Jesus over to be crucified. And so here you can still see, of course, that in the Gospel of Mark, the agents are seen as the chief priests and scribes. That's the party that is assigned blame here. But Pilate is kind of a willing cooperator with this. The Gospel of Matthew then moves one step away from that by having Pilate as seen as being some sort of internal doubt about this. He doesn't think that Jesus is really guilty, and he does the famous makes the famous claim, "I wash my hands of this affair," and then he goes ahead and says, you know, but go ahead, we'll see him as guilty.
And it's in that section of Matthew that I wrongly said last week, I thought it was in John, but it's in Matthew when the Jews, then in that gospel say, yeah, his blood be upon our heads.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I looked at that this morning, and it says the people.
The people.
Yes, ah. Halas.
So it doesn't use the term Jews.
Does not use the term Jews there. People in presumably that would mean the people of Jerusalem there, but a sort of kind of democratic assembly there that is seen as making that claim. Mm. Then this, you know, to step continue the story one step further. Keep going. Gospel of Luke will have Pilate actually try to acquit Jesus. Three times Gospel of Luke says Pilate says, I find no guilt in this man. And then finally yields. His verdict is not that Jesus should be crucified, but that he should be given over to the will of the others. And then the Gospel of John has Pilate not just find Jesus innocent, but actively work for Jesus's release, and is only cowed by the threats of the people themselves to having Jesus crucified. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's one very, very sharp trend of shifting responsibility from the Romans to the Jews.
We have a caller waiting on one of our lines. This is line number one, and others who would like to join the conversation, 333-9455 in Champaign, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. But let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. I have one question which has comes up a lot. What do we do about the war bureaucrats? Seems to me there are many of them to deal with. And so what do we do with the board bureaucrats? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, that's an interesting question. The question goes back to my characterization of Pilate in the Gospel of Mark as a board bureaucrat. And I think I stand by that characterization. Pilate is shown as indifferent. And I think perhaps the connection we can make is that in the Gospel of Mark, evil is accomplished as much by indifference as through active will, and kind of connects to what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, and that this is, if there is a lesson in the Gospel of Mark, I think that's part of it, that tragic injustice can be accomplished just as surely by people not intervening and not pursuing truth and justice as it can be by people actively willing to commit injustice. And so Pilate comes across in the Gospel of Mark as a decidedly ambiguous figure at best.
Another example in Christianity of how the opposite of love isn't so much hate, but often apathy.
Yes, yes, I think that's true. And I do find that the Gospel of Mark is pretty interesting in that respect. Pilate is shown with some more nuance than he is in the Gospel of John, where he is turned into this figure who is shown as weak and indecisive and thoroughly under the thumb of the Jewish leaders, which, by the way, we just need to point out is as far from any other evidence that we have historically about Pilate as we have, who in other sources comes through as an extremely ruthless kind of governor, not one who is easily cowed by the subjects that he is meant to govern.
As we're approaching in the Christian year, the season of when the season of Lent, we're approaching Holy Week and Easter. That's often been a horrible time for Jews in countries where Christians are the majority, because as Christians hear these kind of scriptures read in their mm-hmm. services, they've often gone out after Jews, and mm-hmm. there's of course yeah. been pogroms and horrible things, and here we are singing about it. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that whole problem?
Well, if I can have a minute to think about an answer on that, you're sort of pulling me. I was in my historical mindset here. The best advice I can give is one that I take from Luke Timothy Johnson, who says that what Christians need to do is recognize that there is toxin in their texts. And he calls these toxic texts, that there is venom there. And Christians shouldn't try to eliminate those texts because that's disowning. That is a way of erasing your own history. But once you recognize the toxin, the very sharp anti-Jewish bias in the Gospel of John, you will be more prepared to contextualize it. And I think Luke Johnson is wise in that regard.
Tell our listeners who Luke Timothy Johnson is.
Luke Timothy Johnson is one of the foremost New Testament scholars over the last 30, 40 years. And I believe he is still a professor of New Testament at Candler School of Theology at Emory University.
We have another caller waiting to join the conversation with our guest, Rick Layton. Line number one. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier that the Gospels were written probably between 70 AD and perhaps 100. How is that dating accomplished?
Mm-hmm. Good question. As I said, also, the dating of the Gospels is a very, very tricky and nuanced business. And the way that I work with it, and I'll just sort of keep it personal here, is I first try to set where the Gospel of Mark can be responsibly dated, and then follow from there, because I think it's fairly clear that Matthew and Luke both depend on Mark literarily. So if we can set Mark, we can also then relatively set Matthew and Luke as later than them. And here's the two ways that I've best found to date the Gospel of Mark. First of all, it seems to me the Gospel of Mark cannot predate the letters of Paul. And I won't, this usually takes me about 30 to 40 minutes to demonstrate in class, so I'll spare you that. Just to sort of summarize it, that Gospel of Mark presumes that the food laws, the traditional dietary regulations, do not apply. And of course, as we know, from the letters of Paul, that this is a burning hot issue that Paul's dealing with. So it seems fairly clear that the Gospel of Mark has to post-date Paul. In other words, to present this as a settled issue historically presumes that it's after Paul, which Paul's letters are 50 to 58. Earliest date we can give for Mark then would be the year 60. The latest date I think we can responsibly give for the Gospel of Mark is about the year 70, and that's why 70 is such a watershed date. That year is pegged to the kind of culmination of the Jewish revolt against Rome, which lasted from the year 66 to 73. From 67 on, Jerusalem was under siege by the Roman legions, and in 70, the Romans overthrew Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. Gospel of Mark seems to be written right in the kind of shadow of that horrible calamity. So Gospel of Mark really doesn't seem to post-date 70. So I would put Gospel of Mark somewhere between the years 67 and 70, Matthew and Luke later. Gospel of John interacts in various ways with the traditions of all of them. It's very hard to show textual dependence, but the traditions seem to be there. So Gospel of John would be the latest of the four.
Would you like to follow up, caller? I think he's hung up to listen. Let me take just a moment to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Professor Rick Layton from the Program in the Study of Religion here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He's teaching this semester a course that he usually teaches in the spring, a very popular course on the Christian New Testament. He also teaches other courses in Christian theology, and we're happy to have him as our guest today. And I might just mention that Professor Layton will be one of the panelists at a meeting sponsored by the Whirlwind Program here in Champaign-Urbana. That'll be coming up on a Monday, March 12 at 8 o'clock. at Grace Lutheran Church, and we'll be talking about these same issues with some other guests who've been on this program. Michael Shapiro will be a guest in that panel, as will Professor Chet Awis, who is the director of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, who will be putting on the concert in Smith Music Hall on March 17, Saturday, that Saturday at 7:30. And tickets, incidentally, are at the door, available at the door at Smith Music Hall on the 17th of March. That'll be $18 for adults, $15 for seniors. Students can get in for $10. So that's a very wonderful concert of Bach's St. John's Passion. And again, the panel discussion that the public is invited to will be at Grace Lutheran Church in Champaign on the corner of Prospect and Springfield on Monday, March 12 at 8 p.m. And that's a free panel discussion put on by the Whirlwind Project, an interfaith group that uses art and music as a way to bridge some of the divides between religious groups locally. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this Keeping the Faith program. I'm director of the University YMCA, and this Friday at Friday Forum, as was referred to earlier in this program, Professor Jonathan Ebel will be speaking at the Y. That's March 2nd, this Friday noon. He'll be talking about religion, violence, and American redemption, Sparta and the New Jerusalem. The relationship between Christian faith and violence, paying a particular attention to assertions that involvement in and exposure to violence can offer redemption to individuals, communities, and the nation. He'll be examining those relationship between Christianity and violence. Should be very provocative, and people who'd like to come and hear that's a free lecture, part of the series on differing faiths in the public arena, conflict and cooperation this semester at the University Y. On March 9, Chuck Cowger, a former dean of social work at the University of Missouri, will be speaking here about intra-faith conflict and cooperation, dilemma for faith in building a culture of peace. That's Professor and former dean Chuck Cowger on March 9. Then Cynthia Campbell will be our guest at the Y on Friday, March 30th, talking about her new book, A Christian Approach to Religious Diversity. Don Shriver, former president of Union Seminary in New York City, will be our guest at the Y April 6th, talking about an ethic for enemies, forgiveness, and politics. And then a panel on April 13 will end this series, and Berger will be moderating it with guests Lee Malhado from the Jewish Federation, Donna Mason from Christian Church Women United, Amani Ayad from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. They'll be talking about how to be a committed believer in an interfaith world, an interfaith context. So that should be we think we have some fascinating programs coming up, and all those programs are open to the public. If you'd like to reserve a lunch, do give us a call, 337-1500. But even if you don't, come anyway, and we'll find food for you. Those are some of the programs coming up at the Y in the Friday Forum series. This Tuesday, President Joe White from the University of Illinois will be our guest at Know Your University, talking about the arts here at the University of Illinois. That's this Tuesday noon, February 27, President Joseph White of the University. We have another caller waiting on line number one to speak with our guest, Rick Layton. Go ahead, please, line one.
Yes, historically, do you see any connection that Christianity and Islam might have been a unified force, as opposed to now they're working in at cross purposes so often? Because the reason I ask this is Jesus said that he was the Lamb of God, and except for the letter B, Islam would be Islam. So do you see any connection as, thousands of years ago when who were the two brothers, Isaac and Ishmael, were they? And one became the Arab nation, and then the other fostered a Christian heritage.
Okay, that's a difficult question to, I think, put into a unified historical context, since Islam postdates Christianity by some 600 years. And the verbal play between Islam and Islam would only work in English. The Greek has nothing to do with that. And Jesus in the Gospel of John is actually not presented as saying himself that he is the Lamb of God. This is how he's introduced to the reader via John the Baptist. So I think there's several reasons to set aside that comparison.
Let's talk a little bit about the Passion narrative and the comments there about the Jews. You started by talking about Pilate and the difference between Pilate in the Gospel of John mm-hmm. and in the other three Gospels referred to often as the Synoptics. What happens after that?
After Jesus encounters Pilate. Look, maybe it would be helpful for me to walk through the whole Passion
sure.
narrative in the
sure.
Gospel of John, because it is very distinctive. And again, I think I want to impress upon anyone listening that the Gospel of John is unique in numerous elements of its Passion narrative, and in one very important way, incompatible with the Synoptic Gospels. One way that is historically irreconcilable between the Synoptic tradition and the Johannine tradition, the Gospel of John being the Johannine tradition, the date on which Jesus was executed. In the Synoptic tradition, Jesus is executed on the first day of Passover. That is, he celebrates a Seder meal with his disciples beginning at evening, since evening is when a day begins in Jewish tradition. He's arrested that evening and he's crucified on the first day of Passover. The Gospel of John, he is arrested on what's called the Day of Preparation, which is the day before Passover. And these two dates cannot be historically reconciled, even though I have read many ingenious attempts to do so. And so I wanted to put that out so that everyone can keep in mind that the Gospel of John and the Synoptics have differences among themselves, and both of those differences are very, very problematic in trying to map out onto any kind of reconstructible historical scenario. And so with that in mind, Gospel of John presents Jesus as actually not having a trial before Jewish authorities, which again is unique. He is interrogated by the high priest, who then yields him to Pilate. Pilate has no interest in pursuing this, but he does something that is different from any other synoptic gospels. He has a private interview with Jesus. And in that interview, he tries to pin Jesus down on whether or not Jesus claims to be king. And Jesus parries all these questions by saying, my kingdom is not of this world. If it was, my followers would come and protect me. But the interesting thing here is that Jesus is definitely in charge of this interview. He's not so much being examined by a judge as he turns the tables and starts examining the judge himself. This may seem like a very roundabout way, but I think to talk about it, but it's very important to see why John does what he does. So Pilate at the end shrugs his shoulders, says, "What is truth?" goes out and tells the authorities, who are depicted as, quote-unquote, the Jews, "I find nothing wrong with this man." And they say, "Well, wait a minute, what's going on here is you need to crucify him because he claimed to be the Son of God." And so we've just upped the ante from being King of the Jews to Son of God. And it says Pilate is more terrified than ever. And he starts begging Jesus to allow him to release him. And Jesus refuses. Jesus says, you know, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above." And so Jesus controls the entire event. And then Pilate in the end, is forced to concede that he cannot, in a way, withhold this man from those people who are out to attack him. And so Pilate becomes kind of a victim of being a runaway mob here. So this is entirely different from the synoptic tradition in the sense of there's a private interview with Pilate, and in the sense that he is specifically charged with being the Son of God, and that this becomes the basis then for his execution. This becomes very, very important in subsequent Christian tradition, because it, I think, becomes the basis on which in the medieval period, Jews become viewed as God killers, that it makes explicit a sense that the Jews are self-consciously trying to put to death their own relationship with God, something they seal for themselves in the very last words that the Jews, very last words attributed to the quote-unquote Jews in the gospel is, "We have no king but Caesar," sort of turning their back, rhetorically speaking, in on the entire covenant tradition here. And this is extremely inflammatory, and it's intentionally so, and I want to suggest that it has very little historical basis for anything we can know about the way a trial would have been conducted by Roman authorities or Jewish authorities in antiquity.
So why did the author of the Gospel of John, who you say we don't know who it is, it's anonymous, but why would this author do that? Why would he make this divide? Why is he so anti-Jewish? Because presumably he himself, the author, was Jewish.
I've really been pondering that, and I think, as I said before we started, I think if this were an easily solved question, it would have been solved a long time ago. One of the strategies for resolving this is to say that, well, the Jews, the Judaioi in the Gospel of John, are really not the Jews, but the Judeans. In other words, a political geographic reference rather than an ethnic religious one. And it would be wonderful if we could sort of solve an interpretive problem through translation. I haven't been at all convinced that this really resolves our problems, because they go so much deeper than simply the word chosen here. The explanation that, at least I'll put this out provisionally as I can work with, is that the Gospel of John is, it seems to me, to come from a Jewish Christian circle, just to use that word for it, that this is a text that was produced by a Jewish Christian writer in the midst of a tremendously hostile situation with the synagogue. And so the rhetorical vehemence of the attack on the Jews is very much a reflection of this hostility, the sense of this small, powerless minority sect of Jews feeling victimized by what they see as the majority sect of the synagogue, and really playing that out in this narrative. And to understand why that would be, I think we can look at this one of two ways. And one is that he's just plain angry. That's ultimately not very satisfying. The other way is to see this as an attempt to persuade. And you ask yourself, who's he trying to persuade? And the answer would be, he's trying to persuade other Jewish Christians. Well, what's he trying to persuade them about? And he's trying to persuade them about the need to stand firm in the midst of this perceived hostility. And so the way it works then is to, in a way, dehumanize all of Jesus' opposition to alienate Jewish Christians from any sense of common membership they could have with that group.
So if I understand your position correctly, here's this Jewish minority in a Roman world who the Christian, the smaller Jewish Christian minority is feeling persecuted by, and John, the writer of this gospel, is trying to get them to not give in?
Yes, to stand firm in the midst of this hostility.
We have another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Rick Layton.
Hi. I wonder if I can offer an off-the-wall hypothesis, which
please,
you can easily destroy by simple pointing out that there may be a chronological problem with my thesis. And this is the, it seems from what you're saying that the Gospel of John is somewhat excusing the Roman role in this execution, and therefore conceivably could have been written after the time of Constantine.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that.
I mean, when was Constantine?
Constantine, well, I guess we can date his, what we call his regnal years, from, I believe, 306 to 337, which would be 250 years after the Gospel.
And when was the time of the establishment of the canon?
The time of the canon. Well, that would depend on the particular branch of Christianity that you were talking about.
We'll say the one that includes the Gospel of John.
Yes. Well, okay, just to restrict that then, the four, what we call the four gospel canon, pretty much was firmly in place somewhere between the years 180 and 200.
Okay. So that would rule out my hypothesis very clearly.
but thank you for asking.
Thank you for your question.
Yeah.
So, talking about the problem for our time based on this, before you were suggesting that another New Testament scholar, Luke Timothy Johnson at Emory University, has called these kind of writings within Christianity toxic texts. What is the worshiping community of Christians to do when these toxic texts come up again year after year at the Easter season?
Yeah, you know, I do want to, I want to respond to that, but I also want to observe the caller's last question maybe chronologically doesn't work, but if he may have been wanting to suggest something that is of value here, is that the relationships of Christians to their text totally transforms when they become the ones in power. In other words, the rhetoric of a minority group perceiving itself as persecuted is understandably quite emotional, vitriolic, and highly charged. The problem is when that rhetoric then becomes assumed by those in power.
Yes.
As a way of squashing those that it wants to dehumanize. And I think that's what I would suggest Christians would very, very much benefit from, is a sense of a greater historical connection with the way these writings have passed down through the tradition year after year. The other thing that I tell people to do is to realize, and this again is something that goes way, way back in Christianity, who are the Jews, after all, in this text, but everyone who has denied Jesus. And the Jews, for John, are really not, in the end, a religious ethnic group. They're a rhetorical group. They are those who have chosen to align themselves with the world and its power, as opposed to the truth of Jesus.
And so after Christianity becomes powerful, which doesn't take all that long in history, are you saying that the thing that John was railing against, the Christians ended up doing themselves.
I guess I hadn't quite, I'm not sure, I'd have to take a minute to think through how tightly that analogy works, but I would say that the Gospel of John can be read quite convictingly by and against Christian communities that deny the radical claim that Jesus makes upon them. And
ended up persecuting minorities.
Yes, very much so. So this would be something that would be helpful for Christians to keep in mind. And I think it would be helpful for outside communities to point out.
We're down to our last 60 seconds or so. Any last comments on this important issue?
I wish I had something greatly wise to put out. I think the biggest thing is being able to appreciate the historical gap between the present day and when this text originated, and realizing that the term Jews, as it became used in medieval period, is very, very different from the kind of way that the opponents of Jesus are being depicted in the Gospel of John. They share the same label, but it's not exactly the same kind of theological relationship that's being worked out there.
Do you feel any unease that performance of Bach's St. John's Passion that uses these toxic texts in some beautiful music is being performed at a university?
Oh, not at all, if it gives us the opportunity to air this out. I think that this is wonderful if we get a chance to come to deeper appreciation of the way we relate to our own traditions in very complex and difficult ways.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith today has been Professor Rick Layton from the Program in the Study of Religion here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We've been talking about the Gospel of John and the Passion story, the suffering and death of Jesus, as it relates to the language in that text that refers to the Jews as an opponent of Jesus. This was occasioned by the upcoming performance on March 17, Saturday, March 17 at 7:30 at Smith Music Hall of the J.S. Bach choral work, The Passion of St. John, St. John's Passion, performed by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. The director of that group is Professor Chet Alwis from the School of Music here at the university. He will be our guest next week, March 4th, here on Keeping the Faith, and we'll be talking about the music involved in this wonderful choral work. There will also be the occasion for a panel discussion on these kind of issues we've been talking about for these three Sundays on Keeping the Faith on March 12. That's a Monday night at 8 p.m. at Grace Lutheran Church in Champaign, corner of Prospect and Springfield. Roger Diggs, the pastor of that church, will be on the panel, as will Professor Michael Shapiro from Jewish Studies here at the university, and the director again, Chet Alwis, as well as our guest today, Rick Layton. So if you'd like the chance to see these folks in person and hear a discussion and join in a live evening, please join us. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Story of O scandalized a nation. A nation not easily scandalized. France. The anonymous tale of complete submission was called vulgar by some, brilliant by others. In any case, who would write such a book? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, the surprising secret behind the erotic masterpiece. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with scattered snow showers during the evening, then a slight chance of snow after midnight. The low in the upper 20s with southwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the upper 30s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a low in the mid-20s and west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.